This is Dave Meltzer with Entrepreneurs the Playbook. And this week, I am so excited because I have the COO of the Atlanta Hawks, Thad Shealy, to share with us how do you get a job in sports. Most importantly, number one, he'll talk about not limiting your point of entry. And two, how to get the skills, which is the actual hard skills. For him, it was public finance. Two, the knowledge, understanding the situational knowledge and experience from mentorship in order to get a job in sports. And finally, how to maintain the inspiration when you're paid nothing and trying to get your dream job.
This is Entrepreneurs the Playbook, where each week I bring you some of the greatest athletes, celebrities, and entrepreneurs to talk about their personal and professional playbook to success and what made them champions on the field and in the boardroom. I'm your host and CEO of Sports One Marketing, David Meltzer.
This is Dave Meltzer, CEO of Sports One Marketing, here with Entrepreneurs the Playbook, and I have Thad Shealy, the COO of Atlanta Hawks, and a Buckeye like me.
There we go.
Thank you for taking the time early at Super Bowl to meet me.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming in.
Now, what I wanted to talk about, most entrepreneurs, they look and limit their point of entry. Mm-hmm. They say, you know, I want to do this, and they keep it very narrow. I want to be the GM of the Jets, right? I want to be Mike Tannenbaum.
Right.
Well, you and I both have learned through our journey that sports is an industry, and that we truly need three things: skills, knowledge, and desire in order to effectuate what we want to do. Mm-hmm. Where did you start your journey as far as wanting to work in sports?
Good. Skills, knowledge, and desire. I like that. I would say I think I had a sort of random point of entry, but it really started around skill. My second job out of college, I worked in public finance. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I was an urban studies major in college. I loved New York. I loved cities.
Did you love sports?
I loved growing up in Ohio, right? I was a big football fan, big basketball fan. I never played.
Tortured football fan, right? Tortured basketball
fan. Yeah, exactly. And so loved sports, but, you know, I went to Columbia. It's not like those are, you know, athletic programs like they have in the SEC.
Yeah.
No offense to Columbia, but that... But I was not ever thinking that I was going to have a career in sports at that point. I liked sort of politics. I liked urban studies. I liked urban development. And so my second job, I got a job. My second job I took because I wanted to go to business school, right? And I was an urban studies, liberal arts undergrad. I was like, there's no way I'm getting into business school unless I can show some some background and interest in finance. So got a job in public finance with a Columbia alum who said, I'm an investment banker for New York City. So I didn't really know what the investment banker part meant, but I knew what New York City meant. I thought that was interesting.
You know, I think it's interesting. I'll stop you there. I have this hole in my heart because I'm one of six kids, and all my siblings went to the Ivy Leagues except for me. And the reason is I wanted to play football, and I had like one college that would let me play football.
Right. There you go.
You can see why. But anyway, you know, we talked about one Columbia alumnus. You know, one of the advantages, because there's a big sway in entrepreneurship, should I go to college even?
Yeah.
College is expensive.
Yeah.
I want to get in business. But relationship capital is really important. And I think the experience of going to college beyond the education is just as important as the education itself. And
absolutely,
I find so many very successful people that have learned personal skills and have asked for help from that community in which they're involved with, whether it's Columbia or not. You can go to Ohio State and even get a bigger community than Columbia.
Right.
Just as the Schottensteins can easily help you as much as your friend.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you
no, relationships actually matter.
And you ask for help.
Yeah, absolutely. And ask for help, but ask for connection. And I think it's always like, what's going to open that front door? Right. And when someone feels like, just like we connected over Akron to Youngstown, Ohio, what's that first connection? People who shared that college experience, no matter where you go, right? That's an important connection point. I always always remember that.
Right. Lesson: people buy on emotion for logical reasons.
Yeah.
So I always tell them, find out something you like or don't like, and then move on from there. And people will. People want to help people.
Yeah.
So you go and get your finance and public finance.
And so, and just by chance, I was an analyst at an investment bank in 1994, works 100 hours a week and runs spreadsheets and PowerPoint and doesn't do much else. And yet I got lucky that when I started, the analyst for a guy who had just finished an institutional investor deal of the year on a project financing for the Portland Trailblazers needed an analyst. And I was sort of the next guy up, and I became his analyst, and he was chasing sports deals around the country. And I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. Developed some relationships, got to know exactly sort of how these buildings got financed, fit really into my wheelhouse of my interest of, I think arenas and stadiums are a really critical piece of what makes cities work. And I was like, this is cool. So wrote my business school essays about that, about the intersection of sports and real estate and politics. And then for my internship between my first and second year of business school, through a relationship, called up a guy who I'd worked with, and he was just leaving the Toronto Raptors to join the Miami Heat. And he said, come on down. And that guy's been a mentor and a friend of mine for 25 years.
You know, it's interesting, pick up on one phrase, you said, you know, I got lucky. But before you said you got lucky, you worked really hard in high school to get into Columbia. You worked really hard at Columbia. You worked 100 hours a week at an analyst, which another lesson for entrepreneurs, you know, I had friends who graduated law school, did very well in law review, and they said, oh, I'm making $150,000 right out of law school. I'm like, terrific, you make $75,000. I'm like, what are you talking about? I go, you work two jobs.
Right.
As an entrepreneur, I look at things like that. I go, you're working two jobs.
Yes.
100 hours a week
right.
is two and a half jobs.
right.
So I hope you made at least a billion. But anyway, I think it's important because Mike Tannenbaum, one of our friends,
yeah.
who was GM of the Jets and executive with Ross and the Dolphins, he always said, I got lucky. But most people don't know, because I went to law school with him, that he worked for $600 a month.
Right.
And
oh, yeah.
he has two Jewish parents and $100,000 of law loans.
Yeah.
That's not an easy thing to stand up to and believe in,
exactly.
to sacrifice.
Exactly.
So I want people to know as entrepreneurs, you know, these stories about getting into sports and working, and, you know, me, I had a non-straight, tangential career where I just met Lee Steinberg
yeah.
after being the CEO of the world's first smartphone and
right.
a VC and working very hard but concentrated. And I always said, oh, I got so lucky because I met Lee Steinberg
yep.
and Jeff Moore had left, and all of a sudden I was COO
yeah.
and then CEO of the world's most notable sports agency. But that's not fair to entrepreneurs
right.
because I created that.
Yeah.
I was prepared, and he said, this guy is a winner.
Yeah.
He felt like I was helping him, just as I'm
Absolutely.
Sure you others. So we'll continue.
So a sales guy that we worked with at the Jets always said, you make your own luck.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, right, luck is certainly a part of it, but the hard work, the make part of it is just as important. And so, yeah, lucky, but you got to make your own luck sometimes.
Yeah, and Higgins, you know, you guys are close friends. Matt Higgins
yep.
is an executive with Ross as well yep. and done extremely well. But
a
I love him.
True entrepreneur.
Because you have my dream education career. I had two siblings go to Columbia, Harvard, yeah. Penn. For me, it was, I'd like to go play football at Columbia. They were 0-12.
Yeah, you could actually, you probably could have done
close.
That.
I could have been close. I want to play. That was my whole thing. Like, I knew I loved playing. I didn't want to sit on a bench somewhere.
Right.
But then you went to Stanford and got your MBA.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been my path. But Matt Higgins has a GED.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think he's
absolutely.
As successful as almost anyone I
For
know
sure.
in the business of sports.
Absolutely.
Isn't it incredible?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And yet you, as someone that went to the Ivy Leagues, you don't look down on Matt, or no one ever thinks about that, right? They're impressed by Matt.
I think that it's, I don't know at what point, I just had my 25th college reunion, and like, you know, I had a great time in college. It was not because it was Columbia, because of my friends, because of experience, because of New York. But that, I don't know at what point it happens, but it takes a while, you know, 10 years or more to say, like no one ever asked where you went to college anymore. Like,
that's
you know, right. I think also, like, not to be, you know, I don't have Jewish parents, but my parents were both educators, and education was really important. And
yeah.
that for them, my father always said, the greatest gift that I could ever give you is an education. Right. And that's he gave me a great one. And so
how they motivate you to be such a great student?
You know,
is it guilt?
No, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, it was just like,
so
it was
Jewish,
a real
see?
Expectation. Right. Yeah, exactly. So I'm not. Right. I don't know. It was like there was a very sort of narrow path that my brother and I talk about, like certainly through high school, that, you know, we were middle class kids in Youngstown, Ohio, that there was some understanding and interest of how to get out, and education was the path out.
Nice. Have your parents left?
They're in New York, right? So they actually retired and have a little apartment in New York. So, yeah, so
Dad and I both agree, Ohio is a great place to be from, and we love it.
Absolutely.
Okay,
Absolutely.
So we're not limiting our point of entry. You know, here you are, public finance degree, MBA from Stanford, met this guy from Portland,
yep.
Trailblazers.
Yep.
How do we end up being such an executive COO of the Atlanta Hawks?
Yeah, I mean, so 20 years ago when I got into sports and graduated from business school, I went to Miami and I took, you know, you know, not the super high paying sort of corporate job or consulting job, or at that point, you know, jumping into the tech world in 1998 in Palo Alto. And I don't think people looked at me askance, because entrepreneurship at Stanford was super, super critical to everything they talked about, and highly rewarded and highly regarded by all of your classmates. And so people liked folks that went off and did their own thing. And but no one was, there were no sports programs.
Right.
I mean, I guess maybe Ohio U had one.
Right. Right? UMass may have had
may
the sports
one, right? Yeah. But there weren't sports clubs everywhere. There wasn't Sloan. There weren't these business school kids who got into sports.
It was, there wasn't even a sports law program.
Exactly.
Right? You know, it was like literally a sports club or certificate you could get.
Right. And so in a weird way, like, because there wasn't that, you have to do this and do that, there wasn't a path that I had to go down. And if I had to get into sports through the sales side of things, I probably would not have ever gotten into sports. But it was through the real estate side, it was through the project side, and then I learned on the job. And I had a great mentor who, I remember one of the very first meetings, we sat down with the architects and we rolled out the plans, and everyone was talking about, well, when people walk here, they go there, and the next thing they're going to see is this, and then we have to have a bathroom there. And I was like, how do you know what people are going to do in a building? And yet, like, you start to understand it that way, and you start to read plans and understand that. And I think from sort of just the way my mind thinks and loving the built environment, I think I really connected to that and learned a lot about that. And then use that as my entry point, my sort of, you know, expertise or skill set to build my career. And I think what had happened that, you know, for a long time, sports was really just a ticketing business. Right. Then it became a media business. Right. And then it became a real estate business. I think it's even becoming more of a real estate business today than it was 20 years ago.
That's crazy.
I sort of just, yeah, absolutely. I again, got lucky, right? But like my interests and the opportunity aligned, right? That I like this real estate thing. And that was the need. That was the fear. That was the thing that sports owners knew they had to look outside of sports to say, how do I do this right? And I sort of was right at that intersection.
It's interesting you say that, because I've pivoted my career several different ways, right? Got into internet, then middleware, then hardware with Samsung's first cell phone, a CEO, then into the VC side. But what I've learned about sports is I pivoted from a sports agent, which, you know, is really much, pretty much a lawyer who can recruit people.
Right, there you go.
Right?
Exactly.
To understanding content. Mm-hmm. And we actually are in similar places in our career, because you're actually building the structure that houses, you know, beautiful State Farm, especially Atlanta. If anyone hasn't seen the two stadiums here, incredible.
And what SunTrust has done up in Marietta, I feel like that Atlanta, the venues from 3 years ago to today, Atlanta's a must-see, you know, city for venues.
Yeah, it's funny because I know so many, about a million people are in here, but they're all like, I don't see Atlanta anymore as a southern town. Right? They'll go to Augusta and feel like it's like this is a metropolitan city, biggest airport. It's incredible. But I see the stage theory, which is really interesting when you start describing the assumptions made when building a stadium, like how it's monetized, where the flow of people. Well, where I pivoted my career is I saw that, and I'm a speaker, and I used to travel all around the world just for 1,000 people. I would be excited in an arena with 1,000 people who pay me to speak.
Absolutely,
it was
really
cool. But what I started realizing, it wasn't anymore about how many people were in the arena. Mm-hmm. It was, this was a stage for the world now. Mm-hmm. And when you're building your arenas, not only do you have to build for who's going to attend and park and go to the bathroom and buy food and where the trash goes and all the things that people don't think about, but you actually have to think about something else. How am I going to, you know, distribute this to maybe a billion people?
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
And how, you know, you don't, you know, weren't trained in the technology, but technology is a huge facet of what you're doing now.
Absolutely.
How did you take that on the job training and learn that that side of the business, because it's critical to what you do?
Absolutely. You know, I think it's changed also over the course of time. I mean, I think one of the evolutions in my thinking about sort of what these buildings are is, yes, it is a stage. But that, and how you promote and produce and how people consume that content around the world is super important. But I think from where we make our money right? That we make our money in a very, these are big brands, right? But small businesses and local businesses. And we make our money in a local market. And the way we make our money is to get people out of their homes and through our doors and into the venue. And that the evolution of my thinking, I think, is as the world has changed and we live in a much more experienced economy, how technology is driving so much of our lives, that the live experience is so valuable that that's what brings people together. I remember going to see the Cowboy Stadium, which is amazing, when it first opened, and Mr. Jones took us around, and we looked it up at that scoreboard, and we were like, this is amazing. He's like, how to make it a bigger scoreboard because people could just watch their TV at home.
Yeah.
And I agree with most of what Jerry says. I think he's a genius. But that's something that struck me as maybe the wrong approach.
I agree. I went to the national championship game. You know which one. The one the Buckeyes won.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
And I was bummed because I had these great seats, and I ended up watching TV.
Right.
I love the emotions around me.
Exactly.
And I love to win.
Exactly.
But yeah, I agree with you.
And so, and that what struck me was that, no, the difference is you can't invite 80,000 people into your house to watch TV with you, right? This is that social experience of bringing everyone together. And so what we thought a lot about is, well, what's the experience economy today? And how do we bring that into the building? And so we did a bunch of things that, it's not that they were the first time done in sports, but they were just a different approach, right? So, coming from football, a lot of football stadiums have figured out, how do we create the great experience for fans to get them on the field, right? MetLife Stadium, Atlanta, Dallas, they all have these floor clubs that people come out, they put the turf under your feet, and you go back into a club, but you literally are standing right behind the bench. It's a horrible place to watch the game because the men are 6'10", right? And so you can't see anything, and yet people love it because they are part of the action. We took that concept, and we challenged our architects, and we said, what does that look like in an arena? How do you do that in an NBA venue? And so we took out a couple, maybe about 100 seats that were right behind the basket that are a little challenged from a sight line anyway, because you have the hoop right there. And we took the hardwood from the court, extended it back. We built a three-dimensional hawk bar that you can stand at. And if you have a floor seat, you're now not restricted to just sit in your 23 inches of your seat. You can get up, you can walk around, and you can stand at this hawk bar, and you and I can have a conversation. And we are literally this far away from the action. So how do you create those experiences that people can share with each other and talk to each other and still see the energy and action of the game? That's what we were trying to do. So to me, the technology almost is driving us to how do we create these other social experiences that people can share, and then how do they populate their digital lives through that, right?
I would be, I share my seat with Diane Cannon at the Laker game. I'd amplify it immediately.
Absolutely.
If I was over there.
Right.
And great business development tool, because everybody wants to be seen.
Yeah, right, everyone's their best selves online.
Social impact,
yeah.
Coming from Ohio.
Yeah.
When LeBron James came to Cleveland, it was one of the worst cities supposedly that people wanted to live in.
Mm-hmm.
They won a championship, and I was there with Gilbert when they had the ring ceremony, and they read off the statistics about how many people wanted to live in Cleveland, all because that team won.
Wow.
It's an incredible thing, but it's not just when you're in your business about facilitating the team, it's the millions of people that come here to see the other team or concerts. Here at
Absolutely.
The Super Bowl, your venue is being utilized. The team's gone.
Yes.
But there are millions of people that want to be in that. The EA Sport Party, I think there's more people that wanted to be there than were there.
Absolutely.
Which is great for you.
Yes.
And it also has a great economic social impact. Do you, when you're looking through and developing this, take that into account? Like, how are we going to affect the hotels and the restaurants and all the other things outside the arena? Or are you just looking at the profit of the team in the arena?
I mean, there's I think there's two pieces of impact, right, that go outside of just the bottom line profit for us. There's the overall economic impact and our role, right, in the city of Atlanta, right? And then there's, I think, an even more critical social impact piece. But, you look outside the window and you see all within a fairly tight zone, 35-acre park in Centennial Park, which is the host to the NFL Experience, the one of the top five convention centers, right, in the U.S. that's home to, you know, the Super Bowl experience and the Commissioner's Party tonight. Yeah. Obviously, you know, State Farm Arena, which is hosting this NFL On Location concert series, which is, I think, one of the first times that they've really leaned into it in that way. Then you have all this open park space between the arena and the stadium for all the NFL tailgating and pre-event festivities, and Mercedes-Benz across the way. Having those three venues, an arena, a stadium, and a convention center, all with, you know, walking distance to probably 10,000 hotel rooms, that's a great driver for economic impact to downtown Atlanta. We think that's great. Also on the MARTA transit line. And so we there's a reason we say why State Farm Arena is built on the bones of Phillips Arena, and Phillips Arena was built on the bones of Omni, the initial arena in Atlanta. It's a great location, the perfect location for an arena.
Absolutely.
The social impact piece, I think, you know, Tony Ressler, our lead owner, is a I think is very community minded. He sees the team itself as a community asset, but he also sees it as a community building tool. And so over the last 5 years, we've built 25 courts, community courts throughout the city of Atlanta. We call it building bridges through basketball. But we're not just building courts there. We're bringing programming, after school activities, camps, even special programs like, you know, doing vision tests and grinding glasses for kids who can't see the blackboard at school to be able to improve their lives. And I think that teams have a responsibility, an obligation, and an interest in doing that, and that's been really, really powerful.
And I've sat on the board of the National High School Basketball Association,
for sure.
And you guys are the lead in facilitating the after-school program, so kids have something. These aren't kids who play high school basketball.
Yeah.
They're just kids who need something to
do.
Better things to do,
for sure.
With their time. Last
sure.
question on that vein. Legacy, when you build and run these types of teams and organizations and structures, they have a great legacy tied to them. And you're still very young. What legacy, you know, you're pursuing something. What legacy are you pursuing in your career now?
That's a really good question. I'd like to think that the projects that I've gotten to work on, for a lot of reasons, but have been a part of making a city a better place. That's like, I haven't necessarily ever said it that way before, but I do think that's what drives me in some ways. And you look at American Airlines Arena, right? The old Miami Arena was only six blocks from its current location, and yet maybe the worst location for an arena ever, versus right on Biscayne Boulevard, right on the bay, connected into what was just the Bayfront Marketplace. But now you've got the Performing Arts Center, you got the museums, you got all that development up and down Biscayne Boulevard. I'm not going to say that wouldn't have happened with what Mickey Arison and the Miami Heat did with American Airlines Arena, but I do think it matters, and I think it matters at a bunch of different levels. It brings people in, it brings a really invested owner, right, to make sure the area around them is important. Stakeholders are important, right? You know, like, I'm from New York, you look at Bryant Park. Bryant Park had the New York Public Library, one of the most significant institutions in the city of New York, and yet it was horrible through the 80s and 90s. You know, Dan Biederman created the 34th Street Partnership, Bryant Park Partnership, all of a sudden had a stakeholder that wanted to make something great out of it, and it is. And now it's one of the great urban spaces, I think, in America.
Hudson Yards.
And so Hudson Yards is, right, that I was there 3 years, and that's a spectacularly ambitious project that only a guy like Stephen Ross and Jeff Blau and Jay Cross, who was my mentor, could pull off or think is even possible. And that's having a huge impact. And I think the way they're knitting it into the High Line and into the extension of the 7 Line and thinking about what makes a city is really impactful. And so for here, right, you know, rebuilding the State Farm Arena, and now working with Tony Ressler and his family, CIM, on a broader development of the Gulch to basically fill in 30 acres that separates the Penn Station of Atlanta, you know, our MARTA transit hub, with the stadium, convention center, and the arena, I think is a really special opportunity. I hope that Atlanta is better for it, and I hope to play a little part in it.
Yeah, it's great to create that ripple and see the effects,
yeah,
substantial effects, and you've done that. And I really appreciate you helping us learn these lessons from point of entry to the authenticity of what you do to allowing things to happen and, of course, asking for help and having key mentorship. I'll forgive you for not helping me get into Stanford, but beyond that, Buckeyes.
For sure. Go Buckeyes.
Thad Sheely, the CEO of the Atlanta Hawks, here with Entrepreneurs, the Playbook. Well, I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of The Playbook as much as me. On a personal note, I just wanted to thank everyone for making The Playbook such a success. Don't forget to continue it by sharing, subscribing, and listening to your favorite episodes. This is Dave Meltzer with The Playbook.